The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Read about the methods of research they use and the conclusions. A lot of it's really shaky. They fear, for example, that controlling certain energy waves or listening to a certain type of music or rhythm or whatever is occult. It's usually because they're afraid of it, or they have some theory that this is how music affects you, and they tend to associate the occult with some thing or feeling or impulse or whatever. The Bible actually talks about the occult in much more specific terms. When a demon possesses somebody, it actually drives them to certain conditions like that they can't help, like throwing them into a fire or there's all kinds of real possession is like that. Other than that, you have oppression, which is a general condition in which the occult is involved all the time anyway. When you're sick, you're oppressed. When you're sinning, you're oppressed. When you're in a fallen condition, you're oppressed. We don't know exactly what the role of Satan is, but we do know that one little word will fell him, and that if we flee from him, if we resist him, he'll flee from us, and that we don't have to worry about our control going. So those are two very different types of things. And the literature that I've read in music, I think I'm up to date pretty much on all that's been said and done. And there is no evidence whatsoever of an occult influence. Now, that doesn't mean that Satan doesn't use it in the life of a young person who's pretty tempted by drugs anyway and goes to a rock concert and drugs are passed around. It doesn't mean the music doesn't help him, numb his spirit, because music's very powerful. But I wouldn't call that any more satanic than, somebody in the streets of Harlem taking heroin. It's not such satanic in the sense that you have this creepy spirit getting into your system, making you do things, that you otherwise could control. When you say it's definitely satanic, if you mean by that in the history of it, there are practitioners who were, in their mind at least, quite connected with spirits, sure. But does that mean that it's connected today? Then I'm less sure. I'd like to see some hard evidence. What were the symptoms?
No question about it.
Well, I have questions about it, so what are the symptoms?
Well, they were...
Well, but I question your diagnosis of what happened to you, I guess I would say. I don't question your experience for a minute, because we've all had experiences like that, but I think I would question the way you've classified and identified things. You might be sure that the ability to know somebody else's need was, occult or something, but I'm not. And
No. This is...
Yeah, it's a big world we're opening up, but it's important. Yeah, it does not happen with all temptation. If I enjoy art and I go to an art museum, but I find myself spending more and more time in the art museum, is it possible that Satan is involved because I look at landscapes and I'm spending too much time with it? I've become obsessed with it, it becomes my idol. And it was something perfectly good, painting, landscape, which turned to an obsession because I let it become a lust for me. Now, Satan is surely involved in that, but not in some, I'd want to be there and measure that, sure. See, I question lumping all attempts to become passive in together. I quite agree that there are, you know, groups and voodoo people and so forth whose techniques of invoking demonic powers are so extreme and so well tried that I have no doubt that demonic powers take advantage of that. I have a lot of trouble bridging from that to all the different things we all do all the time, whether they be fairly ritualized or not, to blank ourselves out. You know, people, you know, and call that an opening to an occult power in any different sense than just good old temptation, which is it's awful, but it's something that everybody experiences. I think that the Bible does not give us, it seems to me, a picture of this kind of identifiable battle with forces and stuff like that. Even the language of Ephesians 6 is not, I don't think, best understood as this sort of force against force type of thing. And it gives us much more of a moral involvement, much more of a posture that involves our obedience and disobedience to God's law. And I became a Christian in the 60s, and I'm very familiar with a lot of how you're expressing this. And I've, over the years, it seems to me that I have misdiagnosed some of that experience. Not the experience wasn't real enough, but that I've misdiagnosed it. And in general, though there are exceptions, and I do believe that there's such a thing as demonic possession, and I certainly believe that there are ritual groups that you know, are successful at getting in touch with things. But those, to me, are exceptions. So with those significant exceptions, the general picture, I think, is more one of oppression in general and obedience and disobedience on our part. And that, of course, includes the fact that part of our disobedience is becoming passive when we shouldn't, or letting ourselves in for things that we shouldn't, you know, letting myself go, shouldn't do that. Getting drunk would be a good example of that, but it's no different than handing the authority of myself over to somebody else for some other purpose, you know. And I think one of the difficulties I have with some of these alternative medicines is that it does tamper heavily with the autonomy of my person. And to that extent, I think I have to be very careful to be sure that they're doing something legitimate. Some of them, on the other hand, have a lot of good to offer. And though they come from traditions that we don't know much about, and though those traditions may have thought they were doing occult things and may indeed have been doing occult things, that doesn't make them wrong for me. I'm sure when Scotty Reston was in China getting acupuncture, probably some of the Chinese doctors who administered it to him thought there might have been something odd and occult going on. I think they were wrong, but that the euthanasia worked anyway for reasons that are still not clear to Western medicine, though they're becoming more clear with study. And it was in his case something that I think a Christian could do in good conscience.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just an effort. I haven't studied.
Yeah, these are difficult areas, and they're based on different models of spirituality, as does disobedience in general. And my only question is whether we should be maybe less worried about the proportion of Satan and the proportion of my disobedience than we should just be about let's become obedient. That's my only concern. I think it is a temptation for Christians to attribute certain things to the presence of a demonic spirit, which may or may not be there, to be sure, when in fact we ought to be working on am I obeying, am I trusting, am I working this thing out with the Lord. We acknowledge and are realistic about the role of the invisible powers. I think that's important. But going beyond that to being able to say, well, you know, it's here and not there, and it's doing this and not that, I'm not sure we can. I'm not sure the Bible gives us that kind of picture. But it's a huge area, and it involves a kind of model of spirituality, which is different for different persons. There is a tendency in some Reformed camps to be so materialistic that they don't acknowledge the role of invisible powers. I think that's just as wrong. You know, they fear that reality so much that they would have a hard time identifying an answer to prayer or a miracle or a healing or whatever. And I think that's the other extreme. But this is an issue, I think, that'll come more and more into prominence. We were saying, Laura, in the first hour, that the baby boomer generation is not only a major consumer of all kinds of health care, but is particularly open to alternative forms because of its social and cultural background, and problems with authority and needing attention and wanting to have people spend a lot of time with them, and things that Western medicine doesn't always do as well as it should. And we were also saying that Western medicine is very good in crisis situations, but it needs to work more on preventative and health education and creating a health environment, which is the apparent strength of some of these alternative forms, though I believe they have a lot of limitation, as a matter of fact. This friend of ours in X, my colleague, he's actually now the apologetics professor there, has an amazing life story. He grew up, his father is a policeman in Marseille, and he grew up in pretty tough neighborhoods. And he was reached by a branch of the Tibetan Buddhists who had a monastery right outside of Marseille. Some of them were actually, most of them, from Tibet, and some were just white, Western people who had become attached to the movement. And he, at the age of 11 or 12, he joined this group. And he spent 8 or 9 years with them. And he became a Lama doctor, which is quite a discipline. I mean, you have to study for years and years and be a real expert on anatomy and all these things, but in their tradition. And when he became a Christian, at first he kind of renounced the whole thing as just being garbage and wrong, and he kind of went into a more Western view of everything. But then in recent years, he's been toying with the idea that perhaps there are some things of value to this, and he practices some of this stuff on his family and himself and on his friends and so on. And we finally had to tell him at the seminary, look, we don't think it's wise for you to do this. In this country, we have medical associations, we have exams, we have degrees, and if you want to practice medicine, you probably better go through the way we do it. For one thing, if you did anything that was wrong, you're opening yourself up to being pursued. And then, for another thing, your job is a theological professor and not a doctor, and you ought to make a decision what you are. And he accepted that. But there was always these two sides, which, have we forced a Western paradigm on this person who had a lot of valuable insights from his own position, or were we, correct in discouraging it? I think that simply represents where we're at. I think very cautiously and with a lot of study, we will be able to find out the virtue of some of these forms and maybe incorporate them. And there are more and more doctors who do a kind of synthesis of all these different things. They may major in allopathy, but they are minor in some of the others. And I think that's the way it's going to move, but you have to be extremely cautious because there's a lot of nonsense, a lot of overenthusiasm, a lot of really crazy therapies, as we were saying. I was saying, Laura, I know what your view is in this. I was saying that macrobiotics is a therapy that gives me a lot of problems. The record is not good as a cure or even to help people with minor things because it screws up your diet so much. And it may be appropriate for Japanese fishing folk who, you know, are already well attuned to this, but it's probably not very good for most of us. And there's some really crazy therapies now. I'll try to be very brief about this last part, but we want to say a little bit about creating a good health environment. And I guess some of this we've said by implication. It happens, it's amazing, I guess here's the Holy Spirit's timing of things, but it happens that our country is very actively reflecting on this. As you know, Wofford won the senatorial election very easily in this state, mainly because he was able to gather the sympathy of voters on health care. There were other issues as well, but health care was one of the big ones. A recent cover story in Time magazine shows the incredible growth of health expenditures, and yet at the same time, the greater and greater number of people who have no access to health, to decent health care. In the typical journalistic way, they point out that the annual dose of human growth hormone for a child with severe deficiency is $20,000, coronary bypass surgery for a 50-year-old, $49,000, cost of a Bufferin tablet for a patient in a psychiatric hospital, $3.75. Price of a modified radical mastectomy, $7,900. 1 day's intensive care for a crack baby, $2,000. A 50-minute session with a psychotherapist, $160. A C-section baby delivery, $7,500, and so on. Then again, I don't know, I sometimes wish that I could be a statistician. This is wonderful stuff. Americans spend $23,000 a second on medical care. That's over $2 billion a day, or $733 billion a year. And that has doubled what was spent 7 years ago. And there's been an increase of 10% or more in the last couple of years. For the federal government, medical costs have been the fastest growing major item. And so this is just a huge area. The other downside, there's a lot of downsides of it. Another downside of it is that we devote, as a country, 12.3% of our gross national product to health care. It was only 9% in 1980. And if we continue at this rate, within 20 years, we'll be spending a third of all our resources on medicine. And there is, as well, a lot of wastage, probably. It's hard to know how to evaluate this, but it is possible that overzealous testing, unnecessary surgery, and other kinds of medical waste account for over $100 billion a year. Insurance companies claim that they are losing over $60 billion a year on thieves, cheaters, or just evaders. At the same time, a lot of people aren't getting proper care. It's a very odd situation. People are in the midst of plenty, but they're starving for care. About one out of nine American working families, which is 37 million people, have no insurance at all, no medical insurance at all. One in nine working families, that's 37 million people have no insurance. Most of the uninsured are families of workers in small firms that don't offer coverage. And among the uninsured are 8 million American children growing up without adequate medical and dental care. And then there's a lot of other things. 17% of Americans suffering from diabetes or high blood pressure are going without treatment and so on. Now, Medicaid exists to insure people who cannot pay for coverage. And as you know, each state works out the allocations and how it's going to be applied. And though this costs $2.3 billion in the very first year of its inception, and now it's something like 65% more than that, still, it can barely afford to keep up with the need. It's the fastest growing spending program. Next year, they predict it will dispense $158 billion in federal and state funds. And in fact, Medicaid pays for over half of the people in nursing homes. You have to have less than, is it $20,000 or less than $16,000 to deserve it? Maybe it's less than $20,000 a year. For everything, yeah. So it's limited. So, and that's a lot of money for this limited thing. It's considered not very efficient. And then there's Medicare, of course, which is for everyone over 65. And the question that both of these raise, and that's the question that was in our reading, is what is a fair solution for obtaining aid, for getting health care, for access to health care? Is it merit or desert? According to this, you have people who deserve it because either they can't afford it or because they're in family situations where it's not possible otherwise. And love requires you to go according to the need. Now, another kind of basis would be according to what you contribute to society. That's something of what we have now, in a way, because the wealthier you are, the more you contribute tax money to society, and the less, you know, you're going to get. Yeah. Not proportionately, you're right, that's right. Since Reagan's tax reforms, that's no longer true, is it? The very wealthy still don't pay more than a third, whereas they could have paid up to 80 or 90%. So that's true. But the middle group and the lower group certainly contribute to society in that way. Of course, then you have the other questions, like, should a just society simply give you according to your need, whatever your contribution is, and how do you define need? Is the Christian approach nobody should get sick, and if they do, that's a need? And so because nobody plans to get sick, nobody means to get sick, nobody should get sick, the society needs to give health care to everyone. Interestingly, every state in the United States is trying to find ways to define this question. Hawaii recently decided to give universal coverage, and it reaches 98% of its residents. Florida, New York, Michigan, Maine, and Wisconsin actually subsidize health insurance coverage for the poor. One of the most interesting recent innovative states is Oregon. Oregon is asking the U.S. government to approve changes in Medicaid rules to provide a limited list of medical services to all people below the poverty level, regardless of their current medical status, Medicaid status. And also in Oregon's comprehensive health plan, all employers are required to provide health insurance for full-time employees and obliges insurance companies to renew those policies without excluding individuals considered too risky. Oregon also guarantees that doctors and hospitals are reimbursed for their services, but they have to justify their purchases of costly medical diagnostic equipment. The most controversial part of their of Oregon's thing is a list of 709 medical conditions and their treatments. And how are they ranked? According to their seriousness. Well, not just according to their seriousness, but according to the likelihood of a cure. Or I think the wording is something like, according to the likelihood of restoration to long-term good health. In effect, they're promising to provide universal coverage in exchange for a system of financial subdivisions. A child gets a liver transplant. A chronic alcoholic will not. An AIDS sufferer will get treatment in the early stage, but in the terminal stage only gets comfort care. The so-called heroic measures or burdensome measures are not being paid for. For example, life support systems for babies born after less than 23 weeks of gestation who weigh less than 500 grams will not get it. So-called self-curing ailments, like the getting a cold or food poisoning, sprained ankle and so forth, or rashes, are not covered. A patient who needs spinal disc surgery, which is number 588 on the list, may not get their coverage because it's so far down. This has not been in place very long, so time will tell how effective it is. It has a lot of critics, of course, but it has a lot of supporters. The Children's Defense Fund, for example, is very critical for obvious reasons. They figure it victimizes the poorest children. But the protagonists think that even though there's some arbitrariness in that in the pecking order, it's pretty good on the whole. It reflects international opinion, and it stimulates the economy to some extent, and it encourages people not to be hypochondriacs and so on. So it'll be interesting to see how it comes out. But in any case, this, I think, raises the question for Christians, and it's raised in this long article we read by Outka, as to what is right and just care. Again, I think our position would have to be that we have to measure justice in terms of everyone's participation, not in terms of affordability. We are never going to have a world in which everybody's going to be the same. We'll never have a world in which there are no rich. You can't legislate equality. You will have rich people who can always find ways to get better care, And you'll have poor people who will never have quite the adequate care you can. But I think you have to strive for it. The HMO principle is one attempt to do this, which I think probably makes a lot of sense, though it has its flaws. The idea is that there's a network of health maintenance organizations which encourages doctors and hospitals to be cost conscious, but should encourage patients also not to be so demanding. The services provided should be, on average, more moderately priced. I believe that having patients have a financial stake in the system is probably a good thing, but that they should only pay on the basis of their ability to pay as well. At the same time, I think any society which engages in this, in HMOs, without educating, without teaching what is involved is not going to work. As a matter of fact, I don't think society without a religious underpinning as a central part of that education can work either. I think there's got to be some way in which the center of cultural authority of a society is not regulated by cost and... Hello.
My apologies for being tried to make it here once
this semester. Oh, this is amazing. Well, you've got 10 minutes of the class to go. We're discussing general health care and creating a good health environment. And my last point is that there's some virtue in the HMO approach, but that no approach that's based on finance alone or market alone or fairness to the poor alone and so forth is going to work unless there's a cultural authority, which I think has to be a Christian one, to be a basis for teaching about the principles of justice and care involved. As a matter of fact, I don't believe you can legislate care. You can legislate against certain gross abuses. You can legislate to some extent to encourage, to give incentives to keep costs down and to make people responsible for themselves and so on, but you can't legislate care. That's something that you need to teach, that's something that you need to be convicted of, and that's something ultimately only the Lord can do. We lived in a socialist country for many years, which worked pretty well. They had a national health plan, but they find, of course, there, as they do in any national health care, that people lack motivation. They lack the spontaneous care and love for others that would alleviate so much of the problem. And one of the symptoms in modern France, and it's true of many advanced countries in the West that are going in a socialist direction, is that charitable causes, voluntary associations, and volunteers, period, are simply disappearing. You take the principle of justice and you abstract it from the principle of mercy and love, and you get people who always want something for something, and never will they do it for altruistic reasons. And so we were stunned when we went to France. Our kids wanted to volunteer in the hospital. You know, candy stripers we used to have here and all that. Don't have volunteers. They don't exist. They're all paid. You cannot work for free there, and it's not a concept. If you do, they think you're trying to get something or manipulate somebody, or you know. That I think is the downside. So I think we must redress these terrible imbalances that I talked about. The increasing costs, you know, it's just unbelievable. And that list in Oregon probably makes some sense. And we must make care available to poor people and be less wasteful and so on. But the bottom line is that we're not going to be able to dictate the kind of compassion that is required if we are going to have a generally good health environment. We can do a lot short of that, but we can't replace what only compassion can give. And compassionate people can only exist in an environment where Christianity and the grace of God are taught. And I don't want to oversimplify this at all, but I think that's the only long-term answer to some of these problems. And so here we are, back to biblical principles all over again. Got 5 minutes. Does anybody want to respond to any of this? We didn't really talk much about the reading on this time. If you want to go back to anything on the course, that's fine as well. It's interesting, the readings here in this section go back to the very beginning of our considerations about what is health, what's the concept of health. We're back to basic principles, even though we've gone far afield. Would you, I mean, I think it's one thing to say that there are injustices and that indeed people who deserve it because they made the wrong decision to take drugs or to, you know, expose themselves to something like that are suffering and aren't getting care, and why should we give them sort of handouts that you know, we can't give to others. It's another thing to say that a system of welfare, flawed as it is to blame for the indigence of all the people in big cities and so forth who are having problems. I think that there are many, many other causes besides the fact of a welfare system in place that explain why there's a lot more illegitimacy than there used to be. And some of those causes include factors that people really couldn't help, at least directly. I mean, I think you don't want to slip from a proper biblical view that people who do things wrong, you know, deserve punishment, to an improper view that everybody who suffers is in it because they've done something wrong. There are circumstances, there are victims of things that, you know, they really weren't directly responsible for, that may, you know, I guess another way of saying this is that when we do acts of mercy, if we ask too many questions, we may get into the business of sorting out people who deserve grace from those who don't. And I don't want to be naive, because I know about the poverty you're talking about. Some of it is very self-inflicted. But I also don't want to be, I don't want to dip over into the cruelty of assuming that everybody's there because they've made an act of the will. Sometimes you hear in sermons, and maybe it's a little simplistic, but, you know, the Good Samaritan, he didn't first ask the guy, you know, what had led to his being left in the lurch. You know, he just helped him. And I know you don't want to be naive, because there are people who are left in the lurch because of their own fault. Even then, you should try to help them, but if they finally just won't accept it, well, then you got a problem. So I guess I just want to balance that out. When you have justice and mercy together, it should balance. There's situations, you know, you can't have a just society, where people are getting away with things all the time and as an act of their will. That's unjust. On the other hand, you can't just function with the demands of the law and justice. You also, because then you'll get into a legalistic situation where you're forever trying to figure out who deserves it and who doesn't, and there'd be no room for grace. You also need compassion, which may make a lot of mistakes. You know, we may send a lot of guilty people, you know, out on the streets, but it's better to err on that side. And you know, when somebody comes in suffering, if you ask too many questions, you can dip over into cruelty. That's sort of a very general thing. But anyway, so I agree with what you're saying, that there's a category of poor people who it's really self-inflicted, And after a while, you're casting pearl before swine, for sure. They just don't want. Well, you can't just force them to be better, you know. But you wouldn't want to say that in such a way as to lack compassion for those who are there for reasons that are more complicated than that.
Man bad.
Right, I agree with that. Nobody has a right to, get something that...
But that is a mentality.
There is some mentality like that, yeah.
The homeless advocates and the AIDS advocates and all those, I think they have a right to demand.
Yeah, some do and some don't. I've been in both situations where I think the person is making unfair demands and situations where the person is really a victim. And I would just hate to have... I'd hate to have them all lumped together, I guess. When I traveled in the third world, I saw situations there where it's pretty hard to identify that person as something that the person deserved. Sure, in Adam, we all deserve, you know, what we're getting. And poverty breeds all kinds of horrible things, so that they do things that are bad and wrong, and there's crime and all that. But... Yeah, I know my son's in school in Harlem now, and we walked around Morningside Park the other day. I don't know how much opportunity those people have. They would if they had our souls, because we're nice people who, you know, have been brought up right. But they don't have our souls because they've been in that jungle for a long time, and it's hard to think of that it's hard to go in there and say, well, you can get out of this if you really want to. Unless a lot of other things are done, seems to me. I'm not a socialist, believe me, but I have seen